Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Board Chairman, again, we have Mr. Henshaw on the line.
Yes, sir.
Okay, so make sure. Just kind of shuffling the papers, it's a pretty extensive packet. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
I'm speaking to Mr. Matthew Milburn. Can you hear me clearly, sir?
Yes, I can. Good morning.
Thank you. Can you state your ADC number for the record? Your name, pardon me, your full name and ADC number for the record.
Matthew Sterling Milburn, 045655.
Sir, you're appearing before the Arizona Board of Executive Clemency for 31412A, parole hearing to consider regular parole, absolute discharge or home arrest. I would like to introduce you to the members of the board conducting the hearing with you today. If you can see on your video conference screen, the board member sitting closest to you on the screen is myself, Louis Quinones, and I'll be serving as the panel chairman for this hearing. After me is the Honorable Mr. David Neal. At the center of the bench is our esteemed board chairman, Dr. C.T. Wright. After him is the Honorable Ms. Gail Rittenhouse, and at the end of the bench is the Honorable Mr. Michael Johnson. I would like to begin this hearing with a summary. Mr. Matthew Milburn, ADC number 045655, is 53 years old. He was certified eligible by the Arizona Department of Corrections for 31412A, regular parole, absolute discharge, or home arrest. The crime of murder of the first degree occurred on or about January 8, 1986. He was approximately 21 years old at the time of the incident offense. Does this sound correct so far, Mr. Milburn?
Yes, sir.
Honorable Mr. Corona, it's been drawing my attention. We need to make one other phone call.
Okay.
So if we could get that.
Mr. Milburn, we're going to take just a quick little break here. We're going to stay on, but we got to get another phone call patched in. Thank you, sir.
Okay.
And then we'll just continue from there.
Your call cannot be completed. It's dialed.
Do you wish to rise and ring back in while you're parting your speech? Has been forwarded to an automated voice messaging system. Is not available. At the tone, please record your message. When you finish recording, you may hang up or press 1 for more options. To send it back, press 4 now. To leave a callback number, press 5.
Good morning. This is Arizona Board of Executive Clemency, and we're calling for Mr. Milburn. It's our understanding that you wish to participate in the hearing for Mr. Milburn this morning. And at the Arizona Board of Executive Clemency, we're about to begin his hearing, and we're just now beginning his hearing. So if we get this message within the next few moments, if you would be kind enough to call our office, and that's at 602-542-5656. Thank you so very much, and we look forward to hearing from you. 602-542-5656. Thank you. Mr. Henshaw, are you on?
Mr. Henshaw, are you still on the phone?
Yes, I am.
Okay, thank you, sir. We tried to patch in the second phone call, and we're waiting on a response, but we're going to continue the hearing. So back to you, Mr. Milburn. Mr. Milburn pled guilty and was sentenced on July 3rd, 1986, to include life for first-degree murder and an 8.5-year prison sentence for robbery, which has since expired. He's been parole eligible since April 26, 2017. Mr. Milburn has a juvenile criminal history, including two previous convictions for burglary. The murder of his police officer victim represented a serious escalation in violent behavior. I'll read a summary of the offense in question. Just give me a moment. And this will be a little bit longer than usual as a summary because there's a bit of information to pull the story together. But on January 8, 1986, at approximately 11:25 p.m., Phoenix Police Officer Robert Fike was found lying in a rear parking lot of the Circle K store located at 1101 East Indian School Road by two pedestrians. He sustained a gunshot wound to the head and was pronounced dead at Good Samaritan Hospital at 11:53 p.m. His police vehicle was parked at the end of the parking lot with the engine running and the spotlight and headlights on. His weapon was missing from his holster. No suspects were determined at that time. On January 4th, 1986, Phoenix Police Detective Martinson received a telephone call through the silent witness program from a woman claiming to have information identifying the defendant, Matthew Milburn, as the murderer of Officer Fike. The caller later identified as Elizabeth Hayes, explained that she was employed as a bartender at the Pure New Orleans restaurant, an establishment owned by the defendant's father-in-law, Joseph Puglisi. Ms. Hayes stated that while working in the bar, she had been involved in a conversation with the defendant's brother-in-law, Scott Puglisi, who advised that the defendant had admitted to him that he had murdered Officer Fike. I will move past some of the information, the pre-sentencing information, but according to later in the investigation, it was gathered that Mr. Milburn drove a short distance down the road from that Circle K store. He was in the process of injecting cocaine when he was confronted by Officer Robert Fike. Mr. Fike obtained the defendant's driver's license, lured the defendant out of his vehicle as he was searching Mr. Milburn for weapons. Mr. Milburn attempted to escape. Officer Fike tackled the defendant as he ran, but Mr. Milburn was able to remove himself from Officer Fike's grip. After Officer Fike, or at least it sounds like there was a struggle, Mr. Milburn displayed his own weapon and ordered Officer Fike to place his police revolver on the ground. Mr. Milburn then shot Officer Fike in the face before leaving the scene. I recognize there's quite a bit of information in the pre-sentence investigation, and as we continue in the hearing, we'll ask Mr. Milburn to explain, to explain the instant offense in his own words. According to Mr. Milburn's institutional progress report, he has had moderate programming in ADC. He submitted no release plan. He's had extensive discipline in ADC from 1982 to 1984 for earlier burglary convictions, and again from 2008 through 2016 for the instant offense. He's had seven major tickets during his current prison term to include promotion of criminal contraband, with his last major for positive refusal to provide your analysis on May 19, 2015. This appears to be his seventh hearing before the board, with his last on January 23, 2017. It should be noted that he was granted parole to his next consecutive sentence on January 27, 1992, over 26 years ago. He has some previous letters of support of his parole packet, but also numerous letters opposing parole from victims' representatives. We also have present in the room a representative from the Maricopa County Attorney's Office. Now, Mr. Milburn, this is your first time before most of the members of this board. We'd like to get to know you. Can you tell us about the offense, in your own words, that resulted in your incarceration? Thank you, sir.
I don't really know how it happened. It was a long time ago, but I was under an influence of drugs, and when it happened, I don't know, really know exactly how it happened. I was under the influence. I'm not making excuses for this. I take full responsibility for it. I was under the drugs, under the influence of drugs, and when it happened, I didn't know what had happened, really. It just had happened. I can't really explain it. I've told different stories about the situation while in prison to make myself sound, you know, like the tough guy and all that BS, because in prison, as everybody I'm sure is aware, that, what you portray is kind of, you just build a facade up for yourself to better your position in the prison hierarchy. And I don't really have a good explanation for the incident that happened. I've had many, many years to think about it, to ponder it. I'm just very, very sorry for what happened. I wish it had happened the other way around, that Officer Frank would have been the one who survived and I didn't. It would have created a whole lot less hurt among his family and my family and the community in itself. I can't really explain this, what had happened. I'm very sorry. Words don't explain how sorry I am for what happened. There's just not the words for it. And I just know that, you know, what happened was so horrific, so tragic, and I just feel terrible about it, and I don't expect sympathy or for anybody to believe what I feel. You know, nobody is really, they read my prison record, and they see that I've not been anywhere close to a role model inmate, because, you know, right from the beginning, I was led to be known pretty much to believe that I would never have a chance to get out of prison. And I conducted myself that way, that I didn't, my life was over, is how I conducted myself, that anything I did or didn't do in prison wouldn't make a difference to anything. I have been straightening my life up. I have been taking programs now that I realize that maybe there is a small chance of me getting out. And so I have been doing the right thing. Too little too late. I don't know. But I just, for the record, I just want people to know that I'm not some heartless mad dog killer that went out there that night with the intentions of hurting somebody, and I feel terrible about it, but I can't change what has happened already. I wish I could. Thank you.
Thank you for being so candid with the board, Mr. Milburn. I'm going to ask you some questions. If I read your last institutional progress report correctly, you submitted no release plan. Was there a particular reason for that?
Yeah, I just didn't think that I would be given the opportunity to get out. And I have everything that I need to get out. I'll have that prepared for the next time you call me in to see me. I have a place to stay. My family supports me 100%. That was my wife that you guys were trying to contact earlier, and for whatever reason, she didn't answer. My family has my back, and they believe in me. They get a chance. They're able to see me in visits and know the real me. That what you read there in black and white shows an awful person. They see the real me, and they support me. I have their support 100%. And like I said, I will, after this many years, with another 6 months or a year or whatever in here, so I will have everything that you would require to, if you do give me the chance to parole, I will have everything that you require to feel as secure as you can to let me out and give me the opportunity to start my life over.
So, being as that you didn't submit a release plan, but you said you have one, in short, what is your plan? Should you ever be released on home arrest or parole?
I've been really kicking around. I do know how to cut hair. I've been a barber many times, and I still cut hair from here and there. I'm not assigned as a barber, but I've been really interested in picking up the job as a driving a truck, and I've been taking, right now I'm involved in a CDL class. I'm involved in 5 different classes right now. They're small businesses, job skills, CDL class, anger management, and people skills. And there's more classes available coming up that I'm planning on taking. I'm planning on taking the Alternative to Violence course. Really anything they're offering, I'm signing up for that now. Before I just throw in the towel and say, okay, you guys aren't going to let me out. But so right now I'm really going at it, that showing you that I do want to get out, and I think I am worthy of another chance of getting out, even though the severity of the crime is terrible, and there's nothing I can't change what had happened. I can only go along in the future and make sure that I am more of a productive member of society if I'm ever given that chance.
So let me ask you a little question about your history. I recognize that you, again, were here specifically to consider parole on the incident offense, the murder of a police officer. But you had previous prison sentences for burglary. So what was going on during your life during that time, in the years leading up to this offense?
I've myself as, you know, trying to be the bad guy, or, you know, the tough guy, and that I just didn't recognize really what I had, you know, in my family, and I did not apply myself to what I should have been, would have been better, you know. Could have been more productive as a member of society than what I have done.
Mr. Milburn, I'm going to ask you one question. When you entered the prison system after killing the police officer, were you revered by your fellow inmates?
Yes, I was.
And what sort of status did that give you?
It gives you a definite step ahead of other people, that's for sure. And I'm not proud of it, but at the time, I did brag about it. I did play the macho, you know, the macho cop killer, and I'm not. I was scared. I was 21. I was scared, you know, in prison. So I played for all it was worth. I'm not, you know, because I didn't come here in front of you and sit here and lie to you about things, and it'd be a waste of my time and a waste of your all time. I could easily just refuse the parole board to come to the parole board hearing. People here do not understand how you can be, you know, they don't expect you to apologize or say how sorry you are for what happened. I wasn't a strong enough figure or mature enough to let it be known, hey, you know what, I did that, but I wish it hadn't happened. I couldn't tell them that, or I wasn't secure enough in myself to tell them that. And I very much so. I'm so sorry for what I've done, that I've hurt so many people due to my actions. You know, not just, and I don't say that just my family. You know, I feel very bad for Officer Fike's family. You can't see me now. My eyes are watering. I feel terrible about this situation. But I can't change what has happened, and I know how big this is, how big of a situation this is, even though it's over 30 years ago that it happened. And like you asked me, how did that change my status? It changed my status a lot. All kinds of claps on the back and all that BS that you get here in prison. I've got offensive tattoos on me through the years, and those were just like pieces of my armor. I had went so far as, and I don't know if you have a record of it or not, but I had a cop killer in German tattooed across my stomach, and I covered that because I am ashamed of it. I am embarrassed of it. I can't begin to tell you, like I said, words don't explain it, and I don't have the vocabulary to explain it of how I truly feel about what has happened. And I am a Christian, but I'm not going to sit here and try to use that as something to, get the parole board to lean towards letting me out, because, that's not what it's about for me.
Sir, if I may ask you this question, in fairness, and let me qualify this, this board is comprised of 5 independent voting members. We don't discuss these cases before we come into this hearing room, and I can speak for myself that I try very hard to maintain detachment, to be impersonal and fair. So I'll ask you in fairness, how do you feel that you've changed in these 30 plus years? And also, what do you tell fellow inmates about killing a police officer now? Where do you lie?
Okay, I'm truthful now. I'm in PC now. I came to PC in year 15. And so I was able to, put aside all the prison bullshit, the politics, and having to portray yourself as something you're not. So you ask me, what have I done now as compared to, how have I changed compared to 30 some years ago? I'm not a drug addict. I should say I'm a recovered drug addict. I'm no longer involved in any kind of violence in prison. I won't even defend myself. I choose to live a life as the New Testament instead of the Old Testament. Turn the other cheek instead of an eye for an eye. And so I know in my heart I would never harm another person. Physically, I would never harm anybody ever again. And what was the other part of the question?
What do you tell to your fellow inmates? What do you say to your fellow inmates now about being a...
Right. And I think I answered that. I tell them that, that I have so much remorse for this, for my crime, because of the ripple effect that it has caused, the pain that I've caused not only my family, but the victim's family. And, I've even spoken to some staff about it, and they have been, they see it. They see the truthfulness in me, that I'm not bullshitting them. I have nothing to gain to bullshit them. And for the record, if it's okay, I would like to lift up my shirt to show my stomach, to show that I have had that covered, that I no longer have something.
Sir, at the end of this hearing, you'll be given an opportunity to give a final statement. If you'd like to do that at that point, I would certainly welcome you to. But I think at this point, I'd like to ask my fellow board members if they have any questions. Yes, Mr. Johnson.
Sir, you said that you are a recovering drug addict?
Yes, sir.
When is the last time that you actually used drugs?
I haven't even, it's been quite some time. It's been a few years that I've done anything other than my medication that I'm prescribed.
You said that you were in protective custody. You went into PC.
Yes, sir.
In 2015.
Yes.
And you've used drugs since you've been in PC.
I have been involved in them. I was using them, but I back into it, and I'm stronger now that I don't keep those kind of friends around me anymore. I just don't have those kind of friends. Well, I still talk to them from time to time when they come to me, but I don't initiate conversations with them.
Okay, because I see that in September of 2016, you had possession of drugs.
You're right. And that's my fault because I had still allowed myself to be associated with those people, and the person who that did belong to stepped up and admitted to it. And that's why it was the write-up you're talking about, it was handled as an informal, which is considered less than a minor ticket. It wasn't. Okay.
So during when this incident occurred, going back to when this incident occurred, you denied, you admitted to being present, but you denied actually being the one doing the shooting. Is that right?
Well, actually, I had just walked up on them, and a CEO, walked right up behind me, and that's how the incident happened. They were at my bed assignment, and I would allow them to use my bed, my area. You know, they have to pay me, a little bit of commissary, a couple of suits or something.
Okay.
And so I wasn't present when they did it, but I just had showed up, and I was like, you know, they hadn't asked me previously. They didn't ask for permission to be there. They just took it upon themselves that I would allow it. And I probably would have.
Okay, well, I'm going back, all the way back to when this incident occurred and the time that you went to trial and you took a plea agreement, okay?
Yes.
At that time, when you went to trial and you took a plea agreement, you said that you were present. However, there was someone else that was there who did the shooting.
Yeah, that's not true. I take full responsibility for doing the shooting.
Okay, so there was no one else there with you when the shooting occurred?
There was somebody else there, but he was never arrested.
Okay, so when you did the plea agreement, you said that did the plea agreement and admitted to being there, but you didn't want to be labeled a snitch when you got to prison, so you didn't want to say who the other person was. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
So, what I'm asking you, sir, are you the one who shot the officer or not?
Yes, sir, I am the one who shot the officer.
Okay. So, at the time that this incident happened, were you doing drugs at that time, sir?
Yes, sir, I was.
Okay. And was drugs a part of the reason why this incident occurred? Okay, so a little bit earlier, Mr. Quinones was asking you about what actually occurred that night, but I didn't really hear you say a good explanation of what happened that night, sir.
From the moment that Officer Fight had me get out of my car and pat me down, that I remember, that and just the from the time I went to escape from him or elude him from being arrested, and I had taken off running, and he had tackled me, and a struggle ensued, and the next thing I know, he was I had shot him, but I just don't really know how it all went down. At that point, from the time I tried to escape from Officer Fike and the time from then and when he lay there dead, I don't really know how that happened.
Okay.
And I've told different stories about it to make myself look like the big man in prison. But those are just figments of my imagination.
Prior to being arrested, sir, and going to prison, did you tell family members or other people about the shooting, and you bragged about it and some statements you made during that period of time, sir?
I was so messed up on cocaine that all I was doing out there was cocaine. High on cocaine with my brother-in-law, Scott Pugliese, we did speak about it. I didn't know really then what had happened, how it had happened. I know that I had bragged to him, made up some bullshit stories to make it sound like I was in this. I don't know what the word would be, mad dog killer. I don't know what, but I had made up some story to Scott, and certainly not the truth. But and I don't know what whether you have a description of the story I told you or not. But it just, like I said, it was just made up story.
Okay, so when you talked to Scott, this was prior to you being arrested, is that right?
Yes.
Okay, and at the time that you talked to Scott, you were already bragging about killing a police officer, is that right?
Yeah, bragging would be a fair description of what I did.
Okay, I'm just trying to understand, sir. You said that when you got to prison, you bragged about killing a police officer, but you only did it so that you would be known as a big guy in prison. But apparently, you were already bragging before you even got to prison. Is that right?
That was the only person I talked to out there about that.
But you did brag to Scott about killing a police officer and some statements that you made to him prior to being
arrested. It was important to me for him to look at me in a certain light, and not a very flattering light.
Mm-hmm. So, based on the information that you told Scott and how you talk about shooting police officers, as though you didn't have any remorse at that time, immediately following the shooting, and then when you went to prison, you bragged on it again. You used that as a defense mechanism to become a big guy in prison.
Yeah, I'd like to point out the point this out is that when me and Scott had spoke, we were both under the influence of cocaine. We're not in our right minds at all, and we're close to that. But yeah, I was very scared at both times. I was scared of what I had done. And I was scared, when I came to prison. I was very much scared.
Okay. So I'm just trying to really understand. I could understand you being scared, but, and you say you was under the influence of cocaine, and not totally aware of everything that was going on, but when you talked to Scott, you were bragging about shooting the police officer. However, when you got arrested, you were conscious enough to deny shooting the police officer and just admitted to actually being there. That someone else came up, that you were able to tell a different story.
Yeah.
Okay. So, sir, it's been less than 2 years ago when you were last involved with drugs.
Yes, sir.
Have you taken any UA since you've been in prison?
Yes, I have.
And how have those been?
Those have been, what, since I've been in prison?
Since in the last 2 years.
Oh, yeah, those have been clean. Right.
So what is the trigger, sir, for you to use drugs? What's the trigger for you to use drugs? And what's...
I don't really have a trigger anymore. I just decided I don't want to mess around with that. I don't need that in my life anymore. I don't want it in my life. And my life is a lot less complicated. And I know I'm a better person without them.
Okay. So, sir, I'm just trying to just maybe understand, because a little bit ago, the last incident you had involving drugs, you said that the drugs didn't belong to you, that they actually were some other members, people you knew who you were associated with, they were using your blood to actually do some drugs or somehow, but you weren't actually involved in the drugs.
Right, I wasn't doing them. It's something I knew as far as the people, the crowd. I knew that crowd, and I've stepped away from that crowd because that's not the crowd I want to be associating with, and you know, because they're not associating with the things I want to. You know, was productive, you know, or conducive in what I want my life to be like, and I backed away from those people, and they're just not in my life anymore.
Okay.
On a daily basis, you know, so.
So I heard you explain to Mr. Quinones about. But you have, excuse me, that you have family support and that you have things to do when you get out. But why would you state in your institutional progress report that you have nothing that you, well, it just said inmate stated he has nothing he wants to present or a release plan. Why would you, if you have, I mean, and I believe you do have that support according to the letters and things that we have, but why would you make a statement like that, sir? That would be so important to what your current mental status is or whether you're doing drugs or not. It's almost, when I read that statement like that, it makes me believe that that's the statement of someone who really doesn't want to get out of prison.
Right. I wasn't prepared to make this statement, and he just showed up, and I had just waiting for the day. I was either that or it was in the afternoon, and I had been taking a nap. But I do remember that situation, and I didn't know what to write, and I just wasn't of a clear mind right then at that moment. But I didn't know what to exactly write. I guess I was unprepared. I was unprepared for that, and I just a lot of this here, me coming up in front of you. There's still a lot of thought in my mind that you know I could convince. If you guys could look at me, and I could be this an angel, and that it would make a difference. And that's always been in my mind, is that, you know, it doesn't matter what I do in here, whether it be good or bad, the end result is going to be the same, that I am going to be denied parole. And so I suppose I had, not suppose, I know that I about writing down, being prepared, ready to write my statement down. I should have had a statement written ready for this one. This has come up. This is my second time I'm in front of the board, and I don't really clearly understand what I need to go through in order to be to give myself a fair chance of getting granted parole. And when you tell me, you know, it's like I'm confused to that, you know, like I said, the Arizona Board of Executive Clemency, and I don't know what the difference is between parole board and clemency. I do know there's a difference, and I'm not quite sure I can't think of the word, but I'm not sure of what I need, you know, what I go through from A to B, what I have my rights, what I don't have, or any of that. I, you know, and I'm in the progress right now, or process right now, of learning more and more about, you know, because I was sentenced, my sentence was to go in front of the parole board, but you're calling this clemency, and it's confusing for me. And so I wasn't prepared to write anything down. Now I'm actually really, working at learning and understanding this parole board process or clemency board process. I'm not sure which one you guys are. I don't know. I mean, you call it the executive clemency board, and what I was sentenced under was to see a parole board. And I'm not challenging this. I'm not, you know, trying to come off as a jerk. I don't want you to misunderstand what I'm saying, but I just didn't understand the whole process.
Okay, I mean, sir, it's the same board. It's just a name change. So the parole board, executive clemency board, is the same thing. I just want to, just so that you know, there's not two separate boards, okay? But I just have one final question, sir, and maybe Mr. Milburn, you can convince me or explain this to me. You said that you told several different stories about being involved with the shooting of the police officer. You did several bragging during your initial plea agreement. You stated that you were not the shooter, but you were there and you were present when it happened. And that's the same thing, almost what you're saying about the charge at 16 about the, I believe it was heroin, that was that they found you in possession of, and your statement about that is pretty much it wasn't yours, it was just there, it belongs to somebody else. Sir, you told me, you told different stories, and you said that you told different stories, so can you just, at least for me, you know, how would you convince me that what you're saying now is the truth and not just another story as you've been doing all along?
How would I convince you?
Yes, sir, that what you're saying now is the truth and not just another story as you've been telling different stories all along.
I don't know. I suppose if you, was to talk to me other than on just a telephone, I might be able to convince you. All I can tell you is I don't feel like I have anything to gain or lose to get you to believe me one way or the other, sir. All I can tell you is the truth. I didn't have anything to do with those drugs. I'm not even sure whether it was heroin or what it was. I don't know. I really don't know how to question. How would I convince you? I'm just telling you the truth, and you can, you have the choice whether to believe me or not.
Let me tell you the reason why I'm asking, because we don't have, like, a full report of what actually happened there. But I'm going to read you what, just a brief synopsis, what it says here. It basically says that CO2 was conducting a health and welfare check in Building 2, observed inmate Milburn 0456552 EBL acting in a suspicious manner. The CO2 directed to you to submit to a cell search, and they complied. While conducting a cell search, discovered a spoon with black tar substance on his desk. I placed inmate Milburn in mechanical restraints and escorted him to count movement. He was given 2 hours to produce a UA and an 8-ounce cup of water. And it doesn't say whether you actually ever produced a UA at that point in time or not to do it, but it doesn't mention anyone else or someone else being in the cell. So I was just curious as to, you know, what your statement is and what's going on, sir.
Okay. No, I did pass the UA, I don't live in a cell situation. I live on 30 Man Run, and I got placed in restraints. And the guy who was there, I'm not sure of anything. But the guy who stepped up and took the weight for his involvement in it, he had stepped out first, being patted down. And then I got patted down, and then when the officer went into my cubicle, he immediately seen the contraband, and that's when he put me in restraints. The other guy was in the wind, and that's, he put me in restraints then, and then he secured the contraband or the tar heroin or whatever it was, and he and put me on put me in for a UA, and that was that.
Okay, thank you, sir. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Any further questions from fellow board members? Okay, Mr. Milburn, we're going to move on with the testimony of your supporters and then victims' representatives. So if you'll just remain quiet for now, I'm going to start that process. I would like to put something in context for everybody in the hearing room today. We've had quite a bit of dialogue with Mr. Milburn this morning, and for good reason. As we give a voice to both inmate supporters and victims' representatives, we're going to ask you to be succinct. I'm not going to cut you off. I'm just saying please be succinct, because we do have to manage time. We do have other hearings today. This is very important. So, we'll begin with the inmate supporters, and I don't know who wants to speak first, but whoever wants to speak first from the inmate supporters side, I would ask you to approach the podium. Then if you could state your name for the record.
Yes, sir. I'm Michael Milburn. I'm Matthew's father. And Dr. Chairman and members of the board, for the 32 years that Matthew has been incarcerated for this that we're hearing, it is something that I have detested, the crime. I just there's no way, shape, or form that, you know, that this thing could be anything but just against the way that I feel. I'm a Marine. I'm married to my bride for 62 years. We've raised four children. Our oldest daughter, she died of an overdose. And of course, this situation, which included drugs in the whole thing, we just despise drugs. There's no room in it for our family. You know, if I drink two drinks sitting at one time, that's a big deal. So we have listened to Matt. We've chased him around four different states where he's been incarcerated, and supported him through visits for him, monetarily, sending him packages whenever appropriate, whatever. In the last, since his first parole hearing here, we've been very conscious of listening to him explain himself as to, like he said today, why he didn't get hold of it and get it together, where he seems to have over the last couple of years been pulling it together, trying to. His mom and I are definite Christian. He claims to be Christian. His brand is his brand, ours is ours. And so we have observed how he has definitely been trying. And with the classes and things that he's taken, we're proud of him for that, because he hasn't taken that opportunity over the 30-some years that he's been in there. Maybe one or two times he got a GED or whatever. But we would like very much for you to consider releasing him on parole. He has stated that he has a couple of areas that he could possibly go to work at, and we have a place where he could live, and we would continue to support him to a degree that if he had to go get, you know, start washing dishes or whatever, so be it. But we just, like I say, I think more than anything, the maybe hope on the horizon that he has now that he didn't have. Of course, we carry that hope also, and we're very, very, we have said over and over again over the years how had the shoe gone the other way, we could have lived with that much better than we live with what he did now. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Any questions from Philip?
I'm sorry.
No. Oh, thank you, sir.
Any questions? No. Thank you.
Who else would like to speak on behalf of the inmate?
Hi.
If you could state your name, ma'am.
Peggy Milburn. I'm Matt's mother. I've seen a great deal of change in him over the years, from a cocky young man to what he is now, which is a very caring fellow. And I have recently been diagnosed with Parkinson's and dementia. I would like so much to have him home with me in these last years. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. Any questions from fellow board members? Thank you for your time.
Okay.
Ashley Stover. That's my Uncle Matt. I'm his niece. Excuse me, I'm a little nervous. I just wanted to say that I met my uncle for the first time in prison. He had done his crime the year that I was born. I've gotten to know my uncle as much as I possibly have can. I visit him when I can. I talk to him when I can. He always wants the best for me. As far as his character goes, it shocks me every day that somebody that could have done something like that cares about me as much as he does. I would love nothing more to get to know my uncle more outside of the prison, and I just wanted to come to show my support. Thank you.
Thank you, miss. Any questions? Thank you, miss.
Thank you.
Do we have any other people that are going to testify on behalf of Mr. Milburn? Okay, I'm going to go ahead and continue with the victim's representatives. So would you like to begin on behalf of the Maricopa County Attorney's Office, or do you have an order?
I would. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
My name is Ellen Dahl. I work in the county attorney's office as a prosecutor there in the Capitol Unit. Thank you for the time to address all of you. I've been before some of you before, but not all of you. I think it makes sense in terms of brevity to have everyone stand up who is here in opposition of Mr. Milburn's release, if we could, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, ma'am.
Many did want to speak, but I do understand the need for brevity today. If we could have each person indicate their name, I think that makes sense. If
you want to go ahead and manage that, yes.
Thank you very much.
Jason Bauer.
Please speak real loud because we need to pick it up.
Jason Bauer.
Roger Mars.
Ken Crane.
Daryl Cripplin.
Victoria Fike Mars.
James Fike, son of the deceased.
Jerry Dunn.
Clark Swartzcott.
Barry Roberts.
Alex Familia.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairperson. I will note this is a sentencing, essentially, now as we move forward each day. Officer Fife's son just left the courtroom, the room. It's an extremely emotional day. He flew here from San Francisco. He did not know if he'd even be able to sit here and address you. He did write one of the more powerful letters I've ever read. That was submitted to this board for review, particularly when he talked about the loss of his father at the age of 14. And I know that you read that in addition to Mr. Mars's letter that he also submitted. There were some very good questions that were asked of Mr. Milburn in this hearing, but I can answer some of them because we have listened to every phone call that he has placed in the last 2 years through Investigator Dunn. And while he said to you today that he looks pretty bad in black and white, but his true family knows who he is today. I can tell you he was very candid on the phone lines. I have quotes for you today, and I will be brief. And I brought the recordings, if any of you chose to listen to them, or if there was a challenge to the veracity of what was being quoted. But I do want to go through a few of the questions that he had asked. The reason he could answer your question regarding release conditions or a plan is because Mr. Milburn has no plan. His plan is to go through the motions here today according to his phone calls, and in 2019, then he's going to have papered up his file at that point with programming because he knows that's what you want to see. And he admits there is nothing for you to rest upon today to change his condition. Nothing. And he talks about that, about his strategy and hiring Donna Hamm for $3,500 next year to help out with that presentation. The reason he wanted to talk about his tattoos is after last year's hearing, members of the county attorney's office asked for pictures of his tattoos. And I have them here today. If I may present them to the board.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, ma'am.
He bragged.
Do
you know that we'll have to keep them with the case.
Oh, please do.
Thank you.
Please do, they're very talented.
Thank you very much.
He bragged on March 11th of 2018 that he would make sure to have that tattoo across his abdomen covered up because he knew it was a way to manipulate the board. And what does that say in German across his abdomen, loud and proud? Cop killer. Because that is who he is, and that is what he's about. He's very, very proud of it. As Mr. Johnson, you talked about his bragging. There were things that came out during the investigation where he was quoted within a couple of hours appealing Officer Frey. There was sworn testimony, as he referenced, Mr. Johnson, where he told his brother-in-law that before he chose to shoot Officer Fike, he decided to engage with him and say a few things that were on his mind. Specifically, after Officer Fike pointed his gun down, he then pointed his own firearm at Officer Fike. And remember, he had a firearm with him because he had robbed a woman within hours earlier. So he had his own firearm on him. Officer Fike complied. He put his gun down on the ground. He's a big man, 6'4", had been working long hours, hadn't been home in 2 days to see his family. And he said, how does it feel to be on the other side this time? And then he told his brother-in-law that he said to him, and it is hard to say with the family here, you better start your prayers now. He remembered exactly what he did that night because he bragged about it. And for him to say that he hasn't in 32 years read every sheet of paper about what he said, and now he can't remember, and quite frankly, it's offensive that he comes here and wastes everybody's time today. People flying in from California, leadership from the police department and from the president of PLEA here, all of us working hard to prepare for this important day, and he can't answer basic questions. It's offensive. Thank you for covering the duplicity related to the September of 2016 heroin incident. I won't go into that. The tattoos that you have before you, there are many. They are all, but he's above. On his chest, we have white pride in German. On his neck and back, 100% honky, a swastika. On the back of both arms, white, proud in German. The iron cross. And I know many of you are very familiar with the prison gang culture. We all know he's Aryan Brotherhood. We do. You can't hit because he has the lightning bolts on him. And everyone knows it is a death sentence to be walking around in prison with those on your body without it having been earned honestly. And to earn it honestly, I know you're familiar with that. The other reason, Mr. Quiñones, that you were only able to look at a few years of his disciplinist history, he brags on the phone calls that he's good because all of the dirty that he did in New Mexico and Oregon, where he was housed out of state for 20 years, that those records won't be able to follow him. He was specifically out of state from October 8th of 1986 to October 11th of 2006. So do not allow or believe that there was no discipline history at that time. It was extensive. The victims are on both sides of the aisle today. Having listened to the phone calls, his father has been manipulated by Mr. Milburn for years, and I can talk about that with specific phone calls. April 2nd of 2017, on a phone call to his father, he tells his dad that he's not putting up the money, that his father not putting up the money is putting him in a really bad position. He's already committed. He continues by saying it's going to go real bad. He would never have started the ball. His dad would have said no hesitation. He needs $1,500 up front, $1,500 up front, versus the $200 per month that his dad normally gives him. He tells his dad that he is now fully committed. What is that about? Is it gambling? Is it drug debts? What's his hustle? And we know it's criminal activity because he's telling his cousin Carrie, who also helps him out, when she starts to talk about debts and moving money and money orders and meeting people and picking up packages on Northern Avenue and delivering it to Cassie Grant, she tells her not to talk. The phone lines are being recorded. This isn't 1996. This is 2017 and 2018. May 6, 2017, he's talking to his wife. He asked Michelle if she could catch some ferry up for him, which is money in prison lingo, having for the last over 10 years been focused as an expert in prison gang culture. She says no, and she keeps saying she wants to keep her nose clean. He says, well, then I'm really stuck then. Milburn tells Carrie on June 21st of 2017, he wants her to talk to his sister Michelle to get her to use PayPal account and receive money for him. She's done that a time or two for him in the past, and that he will then give her 10% of anything that goes to her on that PayPal account. Does it sound like inmate wages to me? On July 7th of 2017, he tells his wife, and again, these are all people that enable him, that he manipulates. They're asking about the house that Michelle inherited. She said she sold it back in May. And she reminds him of all of his bad dealings and losing money all the time. And he says he would not have lost it if she was helping him. She says that she is not going to participate in his dealings as long as she's in a battle for her custody, because that could place that at risk. On July 5th of 2017, he asked his cousin Carrie to pick up something of his from 43rd and Bethany and deliver it to Casa Grant. On June 29th of 2017, his mom is upset with him and his dad. She found out about a $400 deal he did with a girl. Mom says, no more money, and dad isn't allowed to give her money anymore without her knowledge. She's trying to do the right thing. It's a mother's misplaced love. But it's wrong. And that's who he would go back to? June 23rd of 2017, Michelle is upset with him and tells him that he's always on the taking the side of things and does nothing for anyone unless he needs something. He doesn't care about anyone, and he needs to learn how to give. And I just have a couple of more. He talks about his son-in-law, and that he can't wait to get out because the first day that he gets out, he's going to drive over to the biological father of his stepson, and he's going to let him know who's exactly in charge now. And I have those quotes, which are quite nefarious, but the one that is the most chilling out of all of these phone calls is there is a caretaker who takes care of his parents. If I may have one moment. Actually, there are two calls. September 20th of 2017, he's talking to Carrie. Carrie told him that he had laid out his entire operation to Michelle in detail at visitation. Carrie realized that she was one of those people doing the collecting. Michelle shared what was going on with their dad because he gave him $1,700 to do that. Carrie says there was no food involved in what he told his sister Michelle. Carrie is upset with him and said to Melbourne that he had promised not to involve her in anything like that. She's not going to do anything like that for him again, and that his mother forgives him. It goes on and on. If I may look for the one where he talks about what he will do to the caretaker. January 8th of 2018, he's talking to his sister Michelle. And there has been an ongoing issue with the family regarding an individual named Sally who is living with and taking care of Milburn's parents. Milburn's sister, Michelle, believes she is manipulating their parents and is convinced that she's going to take their houses and money. Milburn tells her, quote, rest assured, your brother, me, is not going to allow that. She will not spend it. She will not be able to spend it, okay? I've done it before. I'll do it again. And then he later tells her in that call, quote, I will do something that I hope I will never have to do again. And then he says, quote, I never said that. And that phone call is January 8th, 2018, to Sister Michelle. The reason he shot Officer Milburn that he bragged about is because he didn't want to go back to prison. That's what he told multiple people. But it wasn't just Scott, his brother-in-law, that he spoke to that day. He also bragged to Sherry, his sister-in-law, and his wife at the time. And both Sherry and Scott conducted full interviews. To answer a couple more of the questions. I do appreciate the request for brevity. There are 25 phone calls we could talk about supporting exactly what we just talked about over and over and over again. Mr. Milburn knows that there is nothing to support this request for release. This is a chess game for him, a tactical game, and we will continue to show up every time he is up. But it's really unfortunate. The family of Officer Fike cannot even speak. They couldn't speak to me this morning, quite frankly, because they are so upset at having to be here. They're talking about legislative changes. They now are sitting here, and Jim is back, and having to sit here upset, listening to Mr. Milburn talk about himself. He has committed himself, and next year we will be providing documentation of it, to a criminal lifestyle. He basically talked about it to you very briefly, about, well, I just thought I didn't have any hope, so why should I do anything of value in this world? His tattoos are telling. His phone calls are telling. His manipulation of his family is telling. And his true lack of remorse is telling. He's getting coached on what he needs to say for the 2019 hearing. And he's made that clear. And he's got some drafts of that going. But the fact that he couldn't even answer your basic question, sir, speaks volumes. If I may have one moment.
Ma'am, I want you to have as much time as you feel it is necessary. And that goes for both sides. It was a request, but I said I wouldn't cut anybody off. So if anyone has anything to speak or say to this board, we want to hear it.
I know that because I was at the Barrett hearing 3 years ago. We went until 5:45 p.m. Thank you, sir.
Chairman White, members of the board, I'm Roger Morris. I am Bob Fike's brother-in-law. Try to get beyond the emotional side. I want to thank the board. I want to thank Mr. Jackson, Mr. Johnson, and Mr. Canaros. I think your questions were insightful, and they helped us to see the real Matthew Milburn as he is today and as he was 32 years ago. Two comments. In my letter, I focused on what I had seen as a continuity of somebody who has no remorse. I saw that Brad Adocio that Carly talked about here this morning. That was very much in evidence at his preliminary hearing, which was the first time I ever had the opportunity to observe him in person. He was present at his sentencing hearing. He was in evidence at last year's hearing, and I think it's still in evidence today. This is Matthew Milburn remorse, but I thought the best, most insightful question, Mr. Pinero's question, as to why he had not behaved better in prison, and he saw no upside to it. And I'm sure that in your service to the community, you've had any number of people up for hearings who, when you got here, you thought this is basically a good person who made a mistake. You don't see him as a good person who made a mistake. You see him as something very different, who is only going to be a good person if there's something good for him. And that was the essence of your response to your question. And I would also like to comment. He said at one point he was fearful when he went back into prison after his conviction on this crime. At the time, we were told by members of the police department that he had been bragging about being a member of the Aryan Brotherhood. He had not yet made his bones with that organization, was not a member, and so there were already threats to get him if he got back in prison, and so they sent him to Oregon. the Department of Corrections sent an order for his safety, but it was a self-inflicted risk. It wasn't because he called a police officer, it was because of bragging of membership in a prison gang that he was not a member of. And that's why he spent so many years elsewhere. He apparently earned his membership in the area of brotherhood over time. But the fact is, this is somebody who's not remorseful, and I hope that you see him in that light and deny his petition. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Oh, I'm sorry, any questions from fellow board members?
I'm sorry.
Thank you, sir. No, no, thank you, sir.
Good morning. Thank you for allowing me to speak. I'm Mary Roberts. I'm Assistant Police Chief for the Phoenix Police Department, and I represent Chief Jerry Williams. I was a Shift 3 police officer the night Officer Robert White was killed, and it was unbelievably eerie. His body was found, and it was a brutal, senseless murder of this officer who was just trying to do his job. As the board heard, everything regarding inconsistencies, denial, excuses, blaming on acquaintances, you know, that is his course of conduct. That is his pattern of behavior. So what I present to you, to the board, is just like the Phoenix Police Department, our responsibilities for the safety of our community. And the safety of our community is based on identifying risks and prevention. And Mr. Milbourne is the ultimate threat and the ultimate risk to our community. So I absolutely, 100%, request denial of this parole. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief. Any questions from fellow board members?
No.
Thank you, Chief.
The only thing I would add at this time, thank you, is he wasn't just shot in the head, he was shot in the face. That's important. And the other issue is, if he's so remorseful and he's turned over a new leaf, tell us who the other man in the car was. Thank you.
I want to say this again. If there's anybody on the side of the victim's representatives who feels that they need to speak to this board, we want to hear from them. Yes, sir. Please approach the podium.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the board. Thank you for allowing us the opportunity to speak. My name is Ken Crane. I'm a almost 30-year veteran of the Phoenix Police Department. Actively serving still, and I also serve as the president of the Phoenix Law Enforcement Association. Some people call us the police union. We've spoken at a number of clemency hearings over the years. I was here last year when Mr. Milburn came up, and we opposed clemency then, and our position is unchanged. Police, our men and women who in America and Phoenix who police the nation, we are guardians of society. We are guardians of a free republic. And men and women willingly take that job on, a job that assumes a great deal of inherent risk in it. It's a job where you're never sure every night whether you're really going to be going home, but you go out and do it anyway. We willingly take on that risk. It's a servant leadership attitude we take because we believe in what we're doing for society. So, we talk about the crime of murder, and murder is a really horrific, heinous crime, but it's really, to me, taking it up to just a notch higher when you assault or murder a police officer. You are assaulting a symbol. You're assaulting one of those guardians of society that's out there to protect society from the evil in the world. And so, because of that, that crime carries a high price with it. Mr. Milburn went to trial. He was found guilty by a jury, and he was appropriately sentenced under the sentencing guidelines in place at the time, life in prison. And to the point of the murder of Officer Fike, let me just say this. This was not just a murder. This was a cold-blooded execution. Let's call it what it really was. So, he then starts off in his presentation saying, I don't want to make excuses, and then goes on to provide the board with a litany of excuses. I don't want to give you excuses, but let me give you some excuses anyway. How many times did you hear him mention drug use? And I don't remember. We all know that drug or alcohol use is not a mitigator in committing a crime. It never has been, probably never will be. But he's trying to use it as such. He then wants to apologize to you for not being prepared and not having a plan to present. Think about this. He's only had 30 years to come up with a plan. As police officers, when we work out on the street, and the defendant used the term BS, and he said the word, but I'll just tell you this. Cops, when you're a cop for a long time, you have a pretty highly refined BS detector. We're pretty good judges of character. We deal with people out on the street, and you learn to see right through them like a window. And I sat here and listened to Mr. Milbourne, to what he was putting out there, and there's a word for the type of person he is. It's called a chameleon. He will say whatever he needs to say. He will change his color. He will do whatever based on and tailor his remarks to the audience he is speaking to, whether it be the inmates in prison or the clemency board. And there's one thing that he said in his comments that stands out to me. Stark contrast. He said, I wish I could trade places with Officer Fike. Does he really? Because compared to Officer Bob Fike, where he's at is called a smoking deal. He has life. He is alive. He can still talk to his family and have visits with his family, something that has been denied of Officer Fike's family. That really jumped off the page when I heard him say that. So I'll wrap it up, but again, there's no way that I would hope the board would even remotely entertain granting clemency for Mr. Milbourne. It is one of the most horrific crimes, and compared to where Officer Fike is, life in prison really isn't a bad deal. Thank you. Is there any questions?
Well, thank you, sir. Thank you for your time.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. We will continue with the hearing. We do have some people on the telephone. I want to make sure that they're not ignored. Are any of the, and I believe we have victims' representatives on the telephone. I want to make sure I'm not.
I know we have Mr. Hitch. We'll let him identify himself, what he's here for.
Okay, sir. Mr. Sir, do you have anything you would like to share with the board?
Henshaw.
Pardon me. Mr. Henshaw.
Yes, wait, okay, I'm ready.
Yes, sir, and if you could state your name again for the recording.
My surname is Albert William Henshaw with a me, Jr.
Thank you, sir, and what would you like to share with the board?
Well, I would like to share with both a fine boy and teenager that Bob was. I knew him in high school when he was in school and really glad you ever got him into. In fact, I always wish that I could emulate someone like him because I'm sure all of you have known someone who never used to swear word and was just a decent person. And I happened to be in California at the time he was killed. And I'll go ahead and go through this as fast as I can. I'm a very good friend of Dennis Garrett, who was a police chief at Phoenix and one of the deep directs. We worked together, both in high school, and after that, we're still good friends. And then Robbie Musember, who I went to high school with, was my best friend in grade school and high school. And he in the Creighton School District, which I'm not sure, but I think that Bob Fike was probably in the same district. And we both knew him in high school. And I've had a chance over a period of years to talk to Robert December. He ended up appointed by Governor Brown, a probation officer of the state of California, when Brown was made the governor the first time. And I've also talked to Dennis Derrick. But DeSantis doesn't know about this. I've never talked to him about this, but in the past, sitting down with a cup of coffee, when I would ask him questions, and he said, you don't understand how these prisoners are. He said, they do anything to get on probation. And so all of a sudden, they all become Christians. And he said, they tell you everything that you really want to hear and you wish you could believe them. And he said, you end up with maybe between 1% and 3% of them might be honest. Rest of them, he said, it's a big con job. And it sounds to me like he's testimony today, which I haven't heard some of this before, and the district attorney, I have to compliment her, she's very eloquent. And got her points across very well. It seems to me that Matthew Melbourne is probably an alien. You know, I don't know. I don't know the guy, but I know that as far as I'm concerned, it's too bad the death penalty wasn't on at the time because that's what he should have got. And I really feel sorry for his parents. And I can't see any more about families today that are trying to fight with drugs. It happens everywhere, but I happen to agree with Jim Green. I think that there's always an excuse that they can use, and they'll do anything to get out of jail. And I'm afraid if this guy gets on the street again, he's going to do this again. He's going to be shooting up heroin or doing something. And we all want to believe that he's cured, but I don't think there's any way he is. And with all the trouble that they've had with him in the prison system, I think he gets out, and I think he'd be really lucky if he didn't kill somebody else. And as far as I'm concerned, I don't even think it should be considered. And I feel sorry for Bob Fike's family. I mean, he has a lovely wife and two boys, if I remember right. We're a Christian family. I'm a Christian. But I happen to believe for an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth for some of these people. And I think there should be a death penalty. And I think maybe I've said enough. I think you know where I'm at. And I can answer any questions I will.
Thank you, Mr. Hench. I'm going to ask my fellow board members if they have any questions for you. Seeing no further questions, thank you, Mr. Henshaw. If you want to remain on the telephone line, we will continue the hearing.
Yeah, I will. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Matthew Melbourne, you're getting close.
Yes, sir.
We're getting close to the end of the hearing. Is there a final statement that you would like to make to the board before we go into discussion? We only ask that you don't repeat anything that you've already told us. Once again, in the interest of time management, but this is your hearing, so is there anything else you feel you need to say?
What I've been saying and been told for years was a good example of the lengths that are being taken to make sure I'm never released. And that has always been my thought, my belief that I would never be released. So why do better in prison? But regardless of, I'm doing better for myself and for my family. So this parole board hearing is not gonna, throw me off of my plans in life. And, the county attorney, she's done her homework. Certainly I'm planning on having a better parole plan for next year and the year after. And there was not a lot of reason for me to be ready. And I don't know how you could grab me parole with all the people against it. We'd be very unpopular. I'm sure that the parole board would not take that stand. So, but I'm not everything that is being portrayed as me. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Milburn. The board will be going into discussion now. It may sound like we're having a discussion with you directly, but it is the board discussing the case amongst itself before we come to our individual votes under the open meeting laws of Arizona. And again, I state, the board does not discuss these cases before we come into the hearing room. We vote independently.
Shit.
Sir?
I wanted to say one more thing. This is Al Winshaw.
Sir, if you'll state your name again, I'll grant that, but we're about to go into discussion, so if you want to say something else.
My name is Albert William Henshaw, Jr.
Yes, sir. What else did you want to share?
What I have to say, if he really has become a Christian, then I think there's a way that he could work with the younger prisoners and even prisoners his age or older. There's a lot that we can do in the prison system to help these people, basically to help their lives and become Christians. And that's all I've got to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Henshaw. And again, I need to continue with the last portion of this hearing. And as I was stating, under the open meeting laws of Arizona, we vote independently. We don't discuss these cases before we walk into the hearing room. And as I stated, as an individual, I work very hard to put my emotions in check and to be fair and impartial. I will begin the discussion by trying to be succinct myself, and I will state that based on the serious and violent nature of this incident offense, this is to say the murder of a police officer, which in my opinion represents the ultimate disregard in law and order, let alone the murder of an innocent, in and of itself. Not to mention his failure to abide by prison rules, such as the use of drugs up until fairly recently. I do not believe that the supervised release of Mr. Milburn would further the interests of justice nor be consistent with the safety and welfare of our community, and that's where I will begin the discussion. Thank you, fellow board members. Yes, Ms. Rittenhouse.
Mr. Canoons, thank you. I'll just paraphrase Mr. Milburn's own words, and that is, I don't know why you would grant me parole, so I cannot support parole for Mr. Milburn.
Thank you, Ms. Rittenhouse.
Aggression.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Neal.
So, I don't make comments. I'm accused of not taking a position. I agree with my colleagues at this point, and there were so many things during Mr. Milburn's testimony that go back to the BS detector, as was so eloquently stated. A lot of the inconsistencies are, I would say, consistent with somebody that is a manipulator. The fact that he had 14 months since his last parole hearing and claims to have no idea what we want or what we would look at or what he needs to do in itself says that he's got other plans. What they are, I don't know. I don't believe that the interests of society would be served at all by putting him on any kind of supervised release at this time. So I am definitely against any sort of release.
Thank you, Mr. Neal. Dr. Wright.
Yes. My vote will be the same as it was on January 23rd, 2017, and that is to deny Joe Burrow home arrest or absolute discharge.
Thank you, Dr. Wright. I will now make a motion and see where the votes land. My motion is, to deny regular parole, absolute discharge, or home arrest, and I will also ask the board for a one-year set-off based on the year of the incident offense.
Second.
Agreed.
Seconded by Mr. Johnson, agreed upon by Dr. Wright, by Mr. Neal, and by Ms. Rittenhouse. Again, I asked for a one-year set-off because 1 year is the maximum in the state of Arizona. Release type denied. Once again, regular parole, absolute discharge, or home arrest. And the reasons for denial are as follows. Serious and violent offense. Loss of human life. Serious and deviant offense. Trauma to the victim. Serious bodily injury. History of continued substance abuse. Prior history. Repeat offender. Poor institutional behavior. Recent disciplinary infractions, and I'm saying that 2015 is within the realm of recent. I'll ask for the input of my fellow board members in the area of assaultive behavior and lack of programming. Are we satisfied with programming at this point? Right. So, I'm sorry, lack of programming or is programming is...
Okay.
Poor no release plan. And I can't say anything as to demeanor or family support. We have family and community support in the room. Anything in the other category?
I would add a history of assaultive behavior as he had committed armed robbery prior to this incident occurring.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Any further reasons for denial? Okay, Mr. Milburn, we're bringing this hearing to a close. Again, the board voted unanimously to deny regular parole, absolute discharge, or home arrest, and we stated our reasons for denial. Were we clear, sir?
Yes, sir.
Okay, and this brings this hearing to a close. Thank you, Mr. Milburn, and we'll see you in approximately 1 year.
You want to ask that the victims would exit from the south, that door there, supporters exit from this door on the north. Thank you.
Thank you.